We are very happy to welcome Sarah Lambrecht, who will be giving today's talk. She's Belgian, she's a PhD fellow at the Research Foundation Flanders in the University of Antwerp. She holds a BA and MA from Antwerp in Law and has studied for 1 year at the University of Glasgow. She's currently writing her thesis and she's a very active researcher, having contributed to 14 international conferences and regularly publishing articles in national and international peer-reviewed journals. Her research interests include human rights and constitutional law, as well as a focus on the European Union law and federalism. Beyond her studies, Sarah has been an official trainee at the Belgian Constitutional Court and at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. Today we are delighted to hear her present on the following topic: reforms to lessen the influence of the European Court of Human Rights, a new strategy. So we'll have a 30 minutes presentation, and then if you have questions, we'll have some time for them. In the meantime, please feel free to eat your lunch, help yourself with juice and the cake that Anna Julia has prepared today for us. I would like to thank you all for coming, and I hope you enjoy the event. Thank you.
Thank you, Matteo, for the introduction. Europe today seems perhaps a bit strange to be talking about reforms to lessen the influence of the European Court of Human Rights. As an introduction, you see two trends at the European level and at the national level, and they're sort of, you know, different sides of the same coin. So you have push factors that push towards further Europeanization, such as, you know, the supervision by the European Court of Human Rights to have compliance at the national level with the convention. You have the standard setting function. And on the other hand, you have sort of pull factors, which materialize through, the margin of appreciation, and as a desire of states to shape their own fundamental rights protection and have sufficient national diversity. And that is a sort of pull away from further Europeanization. At the national level, you see an increasing Europeanization because of the standard setting function, supervision of compliance, and so forth. But on the other hand, you see more and more sort of skepticism, counter-reaction towards that Europeanization, and more there's a focus on subsidiarity and national, you know, national constitutional dynamic that becomes important. Now, the second trend manifests itself mainly through an increase of criticism. And just to give two examples, the main two, you know, criticisms are the need for a broader margin of appreciation, which, for instance, by David Cameron has been expressed numerous times, but also to mark the start of the UK's Council of Europe chairmanship. And he said, you know, it has felt to us in national governments that the margin of appreciation, which allows for the different interpretations of the convention, has shrunk and that not enough account is being taken of democratic decisions by national parliaments. So this is something that he wants to change. And on the other hand, you see the fact that they say, politicians, but also judges say that the case law is becoming too expansionistic of the European Court of Human Rights. An example is by a former Dutch Minister of Foreign Affairs. He stated this in an official document of the government setting out their human rights policy. He said, "The court should not weaken its own authority by making judgments that are only peripherally linked to human rights." So those are sort of the criticisms that you you're receiving also in official documents, not just in sort of political speeches. And what I'm interested in today is to see to what extent there is a translation of criticism into concrete reform proposals. To what extent is this just sort of, criticism that is being forced but nothing is being done to it, or is actual change taking place to lessen the influence of the European Court? And I'll be looking specifically at two proposals at the national level, the UK Bill of Rights proposal and the Dutch proposal to extend the ban on judicial review to international treaties. And the second level will be on the European level, namely the conventional reform proposals, which I will put more focus on today. So, firstly, a brief introduction, perhaps not necessary. So you have the UK and the Netherlands. In both countries, the convention rights are main fundamental rights protection. In the UK, because of the Human Rights Act, which by references to the convention rights, and in the Netherlands, because of the constitutional ban for constitutional review in Article 120, and that combined with the constitutional mandate for treaty review. So because of that, you automatically get a sort of Strasbourg Europeanization of national fundamental rights protection. So that first trend that I was talking about is very visible in those countries. Now, to talk first about the UK, so you have the Human Rights Act rights, but you know they refer to the convention rights. And how do they need to take account of the European Court of Human Rights? Well, they have an obligation to take it into account. It doesn't say it must follow a Strasbourg case law, but there is an obligation to take the case law into account. Now, this has been interpreted quite strictly through the sort of mirror principle, as it has been coined, and you can take that quite literally. You know, it's a mirror of protection at the national level to the protection offered by the European Court of Human Rights. So as famously said in EULA, the duty of national courts is to keep pace with the Strasbourg jurisprudence as it evolves over time, no more, but certainly no less. Now, the big question is what is this mirror, where is this mirror principle founded on? Is it really founded on the obligation to take into account Strasbourg case law? Or is it rather founded on non-national specific concerns that you can see in other courts as well? And to be honest with you, I think it's rather the second, because if you analyze the case law, you see that the arguments that are raised to follow Strasbourg Court is because of international obligations, hierarchy arguments, coherence, efficiency, and a sort of relationship between the domestic courts and this and the European Court of Human Rights. And internally, it seems based on arguments of separation of powers, the fact that they can't go further than Strasbourg Court, jurisdiction, and the accustomedness to the precedent system, which has been raised as a sort of issue why they follow Strasbourg Court quite strictly. Now, let's go to the reform proposal. So Nick Herbert said in 2007 during House of Commons debates, he says, "My honorary friends and I have debated the matter previously, and our position is that we want British judges to apply the law with regard to the values that we propose to set out in British Bill of Rights and Responsibilities. We do not propose to resile from the European Convention, but we believe that our judges would have more latitude if that a British Bill of Rights were in place." So the idea is that if you would nationalize and individualize your sort of fundamental rights protection at the national level, you will get more latitude from the European Court of Human Rights, you would be more free, you would have less influence of the European Court of Human Rights. Now, I analyze this in depth in an article that just was published in German Law Journal, but I will very briefly go over the arguments. Now, I don't think that's true, because to be honest with you, the stronger the linkage with the convention rights, which is very strong in the Human Rights Act since it refers to the rights, the easier it is to receive greater latitude by the Strasbourg Court. Why? Because it's easier to engage in dialogue, because you're both talking about the exact same rights. And so there cannot be, the European Court of Human Rights can't go around it by saying, well, you know, these are the, you know, we interpret the convention rights and you're interpreting your national constitutional rights, and there's a difference of interpretation. The distinguishment is impossible. So that is something that you need to take into account when you're individualizing your fundamental rights protection. Also, as been proven by a study I referred to in the article, is that it's not the fact of having a homegrown Bill of Rights that will give you a larger margin of appreciation. It's the fact that you have a more rigorous scrutiny. That's why, for instance, in a study it shows that a German constitutional court has a more rigorous scrutiny, which enables them to have a broader margin of appreciation in certain issues. And also, the fact of the matter is that the proposed Bill of Rights would actually weaken the mandate of the judiciary. The proposals are not only to lessen the influence of the European Court of Human Rights, but to reinforce parliamentary sovereignty. And so it's rather a strong mandate that allows the judiciary to go beyond Strasbourg and to lessen the influence of Strasbourg, because you're focusing on building your own sort of national fundamental rights protection. Also, going below the European minimum standard will remain problematic, because what are the arguments raised in the current case law? They do not want to go below European minimum standard to avoid a conviction, to avoid a breach of international obligation, and to guarantee the convention effectiveness. All these arguments will remain no matter what fundamental rights instrument is in place. So, to go to the second proposal. It's the Dutch proposal to extend the ban of judicial review to international treaties. So as I said, there is in Article 120, you have the constitutionality of acts of parliament and treaties shall not be reviewed by courts. So that means that they cannot look, there's no constitutional review against acts of parliament. But Article 94 has sets in place that, you know, you can have treaty reviews, and you actually must do treaty review. And so the convention has been, you know, coined as being the default constitution for the review of legislation, primary legislation, and actually just any sort of instrument in case, because even with secondary legislation, you can test it against the constitution, but barely any judge does it. So the combination, though, with Article 120, the fact that there is a constitutional ban on constitutional review, has been combined with Article 94, which is the treaty review mandate, has resulted in a very restrictive interpretation of what judges can do. So they actually apply, just as they do in the UK, the mirror principle. So they won't go any further. They've explicitly stated that they won't give a broader interpretation to the convention if this is not provided for by the European Court of Human Rights. So they actually have a very similar approach. Now, what is the proposal? So the proposal in blue is what is currently in place, and the red is what would be added. So to Article 94, what would be added is other statutory regulations in force within the kingdom, then acts of parliament shall not be applicable if such application is in conflict with provisions of treaties that are binding on all persons or of resolutions by international institutions. So what that would mean is that there would not be any possibility for treaty review of primary legislation, of acts of parliament. Now, this proposal, you have to see, this is a private member's bill, and it's done by the VVD, which is a party, the biggest party at the moment in the Netherlands. So it's not just done by a minor party, but it's done in the sort of surge of criticism. There's been an academic that has sort of taken the arguments raised in the UK by Lord Hoffman and just translated them into Dutch, and has been trying to gain support to amend the constitution and things like that. And certain, you know, politicians that are quite Eurosceptic have jumped on this, and this is a sort of one of the results of that. Now, what it would do is obviously curtail judicial review and reinstate primacy of the legislator. And there would be no internal remedy available against primary statutes, except, you know, in EU law, they can't go around that. And it's been highly criticized by judiciary and academia. The judiciary has even gone, taken initiative itself to release a statement saying, giving all the arguments why it would be a flawed concept to do this and all these things. But the VVD, it's not very sure if they actually support. It seems like they do support, because they released in the press, they released a thing where they said that they, you know, need to stop the, you know, unelected judges, you know, typical argument, review acts of parliament. So it seems like they would support it, but on the other hand, they haven't explicitly said so in official documents as of now in this pending proposal. What it mainly is, it's not going to pass because the majority is not for it in the Netherlands, although two major parties are. But it's a sort of warning shot aimed at the European Court of Human Rights and at Dutch courts as well, that they shouldn't go too far, that they should leave enough margin for Parliament to do what they want to do. Okay, so then I will move to the European level. So you have the build-up to the Brighton Conference. Of course, you had the UK chairmanship of Council of Europe, and Cameron stated that to hope to get consensus on strengthening subsidiarity, the principle that where possible, final decisions should be made nationally. The Minister of Europe, UK, stated that that they were talking to colleagues throughout the Council of Europe about the right way forward, since concerns about the damage being done to its reputation are widely shared. So, what I will do now is, as you might know, the UK draft was leaked to The Guardian, and so there it's very interesting to contrast the draft to the actual end result. So, what of all this criticism that has seeped down into the draft, and what actually ended up in the sort of compromise document, the final Brighton Declaration? So first interesting thing is that the UK draft stated the court provides an authoritative interpretation of the convention. So clearly refuting the sort of hierarchical argument or incorporation argument where, you know, the court is, gives the authoritative interpretation. Now they kind of went about this in a compromised way, stating the court authoritatively interprets the convention. So leaving in the middle if it offers the or just a authoritative interpretation. So another example is that they say that each state party enjoys a considerable margin of appreciation in how it applies and implements the convention. Now this was completely changed, and now it states that, you know, jurisprudence of the court makes clear that state parties enjoy a margin of appreciation in how they apply and implement the convention, depending on the circumstances of the case and the rights and freedoms engaged. So it takes away the considerable, and it adds in the fact that it depends on certain factors. Something that did end up in the final declaration, just as it did in the draft, is saying that just inviting the court to have regard to the importance of consistency where judgments relate to aspects of the same issue, so as to ensure that their cumulative effects continues to afford state parties an appropriate margin of appreciation. So it's kind of an appeal that they should make sure that an appropriate margin of appreciation should be given. And another thing that was changed is that here you see it was just adjudicates only, and then it was changed into can concentrate on, which with relation to admissibility criteria. So that was giving more leeway to the court to do what they see is fit. Now, what actually did change is, I will talk about in a little bit, is Protocol 15. And Protocol, originally they wanted a Protocol 15 that would include the March Appreciation and the principle of subsidiarity in the convention. But there was a lot of discussion about this, there was a lot of disagreement about it, and in the end they managed to find an agreement that it would be included, but only in the preamble. Another thing that was put forward was a UK/Swiss proposal that was already mentioned quite a while ago in documents of the Council of Europe. And this is this would add another admissibility criterion, and it would make that an application would be inadmissible if it is the same in substance as a matter that has already been examined by a national court, which is very interesting. Here it says taking into account. In the original proposal, it says apply. So that's an interesting difference. The rights guaranteed by the convention, unless the court considers that the national court clearly erred in its interpretation or application of the convention rights, which you can kind of see a similarity with the Bosphorus Doctrine, or if the application raises a serious question affecting the interpretation or application of the convention, which is also an interesting exception because that's the current reason why you can go to the Grand Chamber. So that's a very strong threshold. Now, this didn't make it into the final declaration, but what they did state is that they affirmed the Strasbourg Court's practice of declaring an application manifestly ill-founded if the complaint has been duly considered by a domestic court applying the rights guaranteed by the convention in light of the well-established case law of the court, including on the margin of appreciation. As appropriate, unless the court finds that the application raises serious question affecting the interpretation or application of the convention. So this is quite interesting to know that, you know, it says it in their document on admissibility, if a decision has been duly considered, taken into account both the convention and the case law, it will most likely be declared manifestly ill-founded and land on the pile of 80-something thousand applications a year that are dealt with by single judges. So what actually transpired? So in the end, you have Protocol 15, which at the end of the preamble will add this following sentence. So it will include a principle of subsidiarity and margin of appreciation. Now, what is the impact? What is the potential impact of Protocol 15? It's too early to tell by the case law, clearly, because it hasn't been ratified yet. It's now been signed by, I think, 36 states and ratified by 7. I think, and so on the one hand, you can see this as a signal to give greater deference to member states. And there's a possibility that through heightened use of these concepts, referring to them, and the fact that they have a sort of changed interpretation of the concepts than the one that is currently being used in the court's case law, that, you know, you could end up seeing some changes in the case law. Also the fact that no other principles of interpretations, like dynamic interpretation, all these things, have not been added to the preamble. Also, there is an unqualified assertion saying enjoy a margin of appreciation. The amendment that would change it into may enjoy a margin of appreciation was not accepted. And also, but on the other hand, you see it's only in the preamble because there was so much disagreement about it. A lot of states did not want this in the final, in the actual convention text. So you can wonder, is it just a sort of symbolic appeasement of other states saying, well, you know, to the critical states, well, you can have this protocol if you really want to. Also, in the explanatory report, it explicitly says, and this was requested by the court, that it is intended to be consistent with the doctrine of margin of appreciation as developed by the court in its case law. So they have included this, and it's important because, as you might know, in the court's case law, the court actually gives legal significance to explanatory reports. It's done so for Protocol 14, for instance. And the court has explicitly stated that there was clearly no common intention of the high contracting parties to alter either the substance of the convention or its system of international collective enforcement. And it says also, you know, there is no attempt to define these terms, so we can keep on applying these terms like we have been doing. So there's plenty of arguments available to not let Protocol 15 result in lessening of European Court of Human Rights influence. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean per se that actually, you know, there won't be any impact. So Dean Spillman has said, you know, the reference is not of nature to change the case law of the court. And Françoise Tulkens, a former vice president and Belgian judge, she said, well, in the best case, it's going to be useless. And in the worst case, it's going to be extremely dangerous. So as an overall conclusions, you know, so you see the three proposals are manifestations of counter-dynamics against Europeanization of national fundamental rights protection. But on the other hand, they're also manifestations of counter-dynamics against judicialization of fundamental rights protection, which makes it very interesting because they want to create a national constitutional dynamic, but they want to actually take away some of the power given to judges as of now. And it only remains an open question what the actual effects will be, because clearly the final results of actual reform proposals has been quite meager, but that doesn't mean that there won't be any indirect impact into the case law at the national level or at the European level. Thank you for your attention.